Well, by default, you're kind of a hateful, awful human.
Is that where we want to start this? We're going to come right out of the gate with Firefly?
No, but it's a pleasure to be on. I'll say this at the end, and I'll probably sound fake and synthetic knowing me, but it is a pleasure to be on. I'm very honored that you guys had me on, and the show is really good. It is a lot of fun, and it's filling very well the void that Bionic has left.
Well, that's a huge compliment. Thank you for being here.
Yes.
Lending your credibility to our no-name podcast.
Yeah, I don't know about that. You should see some of these iTunes reviews. I'm not sure I'm the credible one, but I appreciate it nevertheless.
They're full of crap. As I've clearly established, I'm a huge Casey List fan, regardless of Firefly and other things. Yeah.
Despite your poor taste in Western sci-fi TV shows / movies.
Yes.
I'm very pleased. If I were Mike, I would say I was chuffed that you actually spent the time to go back and rewatch all of them and realize that they're not complete shit.
Well, I felt obligated to do it because, you know, everybody has seen them usually likes them, with the exception of Dan and myself. And so I was like,
okay, Dan, you too?
I haven't watched any of them.
But he doesn't like Star Trek or The Simpsons or anything. So
I don't really do fantasy stuff. It's
not fantasy. Anyway, yeah. So his opinion's kind of not great.
So does that mean Dan,
on this genre?
So Dan, you didn't like Lord of the Rings?
God, we're starting this episode off great.
No, hold on. just answer the question, Dan.
No.
Okay, I hated him.
Okay, good. I watched most of the first one and said, what is this garbage? And I never looked at them again, except until recently The Hobbit was on and I tried to watch that. And it was just astounding how bad that is.
Yeah. See, I watched all three of the original Lord of the Rings and I did not like them at all. And that is an extraordinarily unpopular opinion.
Well, just so we don't lose all of our listeners, I liked them, but I don't like the four endings of the third one, because it just kept going and that drove me nuts. I didn't really care for that. But yeah, so just so we don't lose everyone, I will say that those positive things.
Wait, is this the show? Are we started?
This is totally the show.
Oh, great. Well, there goes whatever credibility I had left. He doesn't like Lord of the Rings? What?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's all right.
Oh, God, I have so many bullet points for Casey to talk about.
Oh?
I don't even know where to start. I mean, we should have had you on for our 90s nostalgia week, just with everything in your history, with the TRL and what was it, the Woodstock 99 stuff that you found recently?
Yes! Oh, I was watching that just this weekend. It was magnificent in its awfulness.
Can I just say, the fact that you singled out Vertical Horizon as the reason you were super excited just blew my mind.
Because you were right there with me, totally engaged on Vertical Horizon?
I had to look them up again to remember what their song was. I knew the name, because people used to make fun of the name.
Wait, did you just say what their song was, implying there was one and only one?
Presumably. I honestly don't even remember what I looked up now.
That's the only one. Everything You Want is the song you're thinking of, and it is the only one anyone knows.
Right.
But in actuality, so that was like, I can't believe I've got myself started, but now I'm committed. That was like their third or fourth album or something like that. And their first couple of albums were just the two singers on acoustic guitars. And it was very actually closer to folk music, by my estimation, than it was rock music or pop, or whatever you call it, that Everything You Want was. And they're actually unbelievably good albums. And I've seen Vertical Horizon live a handful of times, and they were unbelievably good back when these two guys were still in the band. Now one of them, the not lead singer, has since left. And again, speaking of unpopular opinions, nobody likes Vertical Horizon except me, but they are actually unbelievably talented and really good. So there. So what did you like in the Woodstock 99 list that I accumulated and put together?
Oh, God, now I have to open it up again.
As we established when Casey and I talked about it on Tangential Number 3, John Chigi's podcast, I was not as amped by the Woodstock 99 list, mostly because I have negative thoughts and feelings about some of the participants.
Yeah, it mostly just makes me feel like a teenager again, and none of that is a good feeling at all.
So, just anxiety and sweaty?
Yeah, totally. Oh, God. Well, there's Counting Crows, Dave Matthews Band, Limp Bizkit, Rage Against... Oh, Rage Against the Machine, of course.
Why not?
They're good. God, Collective Soul.
Yeah, I only knew one of their songs. Something About You're the One That I Love. That's probably not the title, but...
They got a couple radio hits out of that. I remember them around. God, this is just so... there's so much bad music in here. What is the String Cheese Incident?
The only reason I know them, they're like a jazzy acoustic group, I believe. And the only reason I know them is they did actually, and this is true, they did a really good cover of Take Five, the Dave Brubeck Quartet song. It's mm-hmm. Dave Brubeck who wrote it. It's like the quintessential jazz song, and they did an unbelievably good cover of it. I have no idea when it was. It was like this. I found this like during the Napster era. So I was probably looking for Take Five covers because I was bored and not doing what I was supposed to be doing at college. And I found the String Cheese Incident did one, and I still have it somewhere. And it is tremendous, but that's the only song of theirs I've ever heard. And it's not even their song.
Well, that was kind of a thing back then, wasn't it? That somebody would have one hit song on the radio and suddenly they'd be in a show like this and nobody would know any of their music and it was just a disaster. Like, oh, Brian Setzer Orchestra. Like, why are they here?
Well, I love that one of the bands, which I'd never heard of before, is The Tragically Hip. Like, I don't think I could have made that up and stuck that in and gotten away with it if it weren't real.
Never heard of them.
Neither have I, but apparently they were tragically hip.
Yeah. Irony.
How did they convince DMX to show up to this thing?
Who knows? That's right. I was watching Limp Bizkit's performance over the weekend because this came up in conversation with a friend of mine. And he was like, oh my God, you've got to watch Limp Bizkit's because they did Fred Durst like jumps on a table in the middle of the crowd and like crowd surfs. And it's amazing. And so I was multitasking. I forget what else I was doing, but I was watching this, and firstly, they were colossally bad. Like, I cannot even begin to describe to you how bad this concert was. But secondly, eventually they pan over to the side of the stage because Fred Durst, the singer, goes walking over to the side of the stage, and there's Puff Daddy, P. Diddy, P. Money, whatever he was calling himself at that point, God, I'm old, and Kid Rock standing on the edge of the stage and with Fred Durst singing like at them. And it was the most 1999 moment I'd ever seen in my life. It was amazing.
I have that nostalgia blindness too. Like I remember when, I'm sure you remember as well, New Year's Eve, 1999, Limp Bizkit played on the MTV, their little TRL stage for the countdown. And I remember mm-hmm. them doing a really cool version of Prince's 1999. And I could never, like, I never recorded it because, you know, VHS or whatever back then. And like every 5 or 10 years, I would remember to look it up online to see if I could find it. And I never could up until like 2 years ago. And I found it and I watched it. And I'm like, yes, it's going to be awesome. And I watched it. It was like, oh my God, this is a disaster. Why am I watching this? It's horrifying.
Yeah, yeah, calling Fred Durst a singer is really generous, I think, in retrospect. But
yes, he probably prefers to be known as the director of those videos. Did you know he directed a bunch of his own music videos?
Well, the really frustrating thing about it was I actually, to this day, really, really, really honestly adore one Limp Bizkit song, which I believe is called Rearranged. I might have that wrong. But anyways, they played it during their set at Woodstock. And here it was. This was my crowning moment because I hate pretty much every other Limp Bizkit song I've ever heard. And I hear them play the opening bass riff of Rearranged. And I get all excited with myself. And within 30 seconds, I felt like my ears were bleeding. The live performance was so bad. And this was like pre-auto-tune to the best of my knowledge. But it was painful. It was so bad. But some of the other ones are good. Like Live, the band Live, was awesome. I thought Vertical Horizon set was good. I've watched a couple minutes of Dave Matthews, and the little bit I saw was good. I watched a few minutes of Alanis's. That was good. So a lot of the stuff there is good. Jamiroquai, who I've only gotten into recently... Yeah, it was a little weird.
I still like the video, that one video. What was it?
Virtual Insanity.
Yeah, I still love that music video. It's great.
Oh, it's so good. so good.
Watch it on pop-up video where they would show all the little fun factoids about how it was how the set was broken. It was supposed to flood with all that goop and everything.
I still hate his hat.
It's the style at the time.
Uh-huh. Well, how do you feel about Pharrell's?
Well, I wasn't a huge fan of that one either.
It looks like he's about to start hanging out with Smokey the Bear.
It's true. Oh, man. That was nostalgia.
See, the Roots were there. That's good. James Brown. How was James Brown there?
Who knows? I actually saw him play with Dave Matthews. One song. It was amazing. It was Sex Machine, if I'm not mistaken. It was pretty cool.
Dave Matthews Band.
Oh, I whatever you have to say about Dave Matthews and how crappy they are, I'm sure that I've heard worse from pretty much everyone under the sun.
I've got nothing to say. I've had the argument with so many people so many times, and I know some people who go to that, like, he does that 2-day long concert up in the Pacific Northwest or whatever, where everyone camps out and just watches him. And I know people that go to that and they love it. And it's just I can't do the Dave Matthews Band.
Yeah, almost a month and a day ago. I went to my 22nd Dave Matthews concert.
Holy crap. I was going to let all the Dave Matthews Band stuff go and just be like, okay, I'll let Dan get it out of his system and then we won't talk about it anymore. and then all of a sudden you just said 22nd concert? Oh my God.
Yep. Every time it's different. Don't let Marco tell you otherwise.
Yeah, you might have a problem, Casey. You might need to seek some help for that.
Oh, I have bad taste in music, but Marco has colossally bad taste in music. So yeah, I still have that going for me.
I think he's like gleeful about his bad taste in music.
That is true. Yeah, that is very true.
I can respect that. Yes, I do agree with you that I would probably rather listen to Dave Matthews Band than the Fish stuff or Criss Cross, Gonna Make You Jump stuff.
Man.
Yep.
It's all right. I'm not going to pretend like I have the greatest taste in music. We talk about it all the time, how I love terrible pop music, and so do you, Joe. So I'm going to out you.
Oh, yeah.
Well.
Such as? Wait,
such as what?
Oh, I don't know. Kesha, Katy Perry, all that terrible poppy stuff.
That is pretty terrible.
Oh, do you like Pitbull, Casey?
No. Goodness, no.
Because I listen to Pitbull.
No, it's
just the worst. Just to give you some perspective.
So really what we've learned is all of us have colossally bad taste in music. It's just a matter of in which direction.
But it's our colossally bad taste, and it's what makes us who we are. Yeah. And isn't that really what podcasting is all about? Getting down to the who we are.
Something like that.
Speaking of, your new show is great.
Oh, thank you. I was about to ask, is this a show about feelings?
Absolutely.
No, it's very kind of you to say.
It's either that or we talk about BMWs.
No. Oh, well, yeah, sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, most people would probably choose feelings.
Well, we have those. We don't have the others.
You could.
You could have feelings about BMWs.
I have feelings. I still prefer Mercedes, but, you know, we'll... This episode's already contentious enough. Right. Yes, I'm 50. You know what? The past 3 days, I've been laying in bed because I threw my back out. Of course I'm 50 years old.
I'm sorry. I really shouldn't laugh like that.
No, it's fine. It's fine. It's just been the tragedy that is my life for the past, like, 4 years.
Dan's pain's entertainment, so it's fine.
Maybe not for Dan, though. Oh, goodness. That's no fun.
But speaking of colossally bad taste in things, what would you say about your media consumption? Like, I know you like Top Gear. Like, that's your claim to fame, which kind of unites feelings and cars. But what else is there out there for Casey Liss?
TV-wise...
What media would you like to be known for?
What media would I like to be known for? Well done. I don't know. Lately, what am I watching these days? I really like Castle because of Nathan Fillion from Firefly. And the first season or two were really rough because the writing was not good. But it got pretty good. So I really enjoy Castle. What else have we... I used to watch How I Met Your Mother. Last season of that was just atrociously bad. I don't know. I don't watch that much TV. We're getting into football season, so that's a big deal for me.
Ooh, one of those rare nerds that likes nerdy things and sports?
Only football, really. Like, I don't do baseball, which on paper seems like it would be up my alley because it's all about, like, math and nerdy crap, but I can't stand it. I hate baseball.
No, it's about beer and hot dogs.
If you say so. but yeah, so I care for both college football and NFL football, but outside of that, I don't really pay much attention to sports.
Who are your teams? Do you stay local?
No, well, sort of. So my college football team is my, well, I have three sort of kind of. My first and foremost is my alma mater, which is Virginia Tech. And then secondly is my wife's alma mater, the University of Virginia, who is one of Virginia Tech's biggest rivals. So that makes for uncomfortable Novembers when we play each other. And also uncomfortable Saturdays because we actually have season tickets to UVA. And then both my younger brothers went to Penn State. So I kind of sort of pay attention to them when I can. And then in the NFL, the New York Giants, because my granddad has been a fan of theirs since pretty much the franchise started.
It's a pretty solid pedigree of sport teams there.
It's not bad. The college teams have been terrible these days, but whatever. No, because you guys don't really do sports, I assume?
Oh, no.
Definitely not. I kind of do. I'm tangentially in a lot of professional football, but I played just about everything and then basically settled on lacrosse as the only thing I was remotely good at. So that's kind of where I stopped mentally. But I occasionally get roped into watching professional.
Did you grow up in the Northeast? Because I thought lacrosse was generally a Northeast or maybe even Mid-Atlantic thing.
It is. The guy in my high school came from back east and started one when I was a sophomore in high school, and we were surprisingly good, so I kind of stuck with it through college a little bit, and then I had to worry more about grades than what I did after class, so I dropped the lacrosse and went to film school.
How'd that work out for you?
Look at me now.
Well, I don't think there was much of a career in professional lacrosse playing, so it's probably
are you
the
aware
best.
That there is a professional lacrosse league?
No, but that's why I just said that.
Yeah, exactly. Professional Touché. Lacrosse players, I think they make like $6,000 a year or something. And they're all bigger and stronger than me.
Yeah. I am neither big nor strong, so there's no chance I was going to make money off my body. That came out, and now I already wish I had that moment back.
There's a title. Oh, God.
I'm going to regret that one something awful. And I'm sober.
Oh, dear.
So no Tito's today?
No, not today. I didn't know if it was this kind of a show.
Oh, yes. And
You
live and learn. Next time. But
yeah, when you have me back, I'll be six sheets to the wind then.
Those always turn out great.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you about your TRL experience, since I have yet to find the recording device that would allow you to transfer your VHS to digital.
Right.
Is there an extensive story behind it?
Not extensive. I'll try to be as brief as I can. So I grew up about a 2-hour train ride from New York City. And my friends and I, when we were back from college, I want to say this was the summer of 2001, we went to Manhattan just to goof off and screw around. And we noticed at 1515 Broadway, which is MTV Studios, there was this huge line, just enormous line. We had no idea why. And it was, I don't know, 1 or 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And I think TRL started at like 3 or something like that at the time. And so one of my friends who is extremely outgoing, Spencer, he took it upon himself to investigate what was going on. And nobody really knew in line. They just knew that something cool was going to happen. And everyone else was convinced that something cool was going to happen. And they all just started lining up. And so we were like, well, screw it. Let's get in line. So we end up getting ushered into the studios, and we had to like empty our pockets of cell phones and stuff like that, which was kind of funny because this is the era when they probably told us to empty beepers and cell phones. That's how long ago this was. And we get ushered into the studio, into the TRL studio, and come to find out that the gag for this particular episode of TRL was that this woman, a recording artist, Willa Ford or Williford or something like that, who nobody has ever really heard of.
I've heard of her. I wanna be there,
make that look so good. She was, if memory serves, she was on the street in Times Square with like this whole mob of people. And then Carson Daly was in the studio with his own audience full of people. And the gag was that they were like competing in trivia or some like silly trivia game. And if Carson's group didn't answer enough questions, or if Willa's group answered more questions right, what have you, they would switch. And so all of the people in the studio would go outside, and Willa's group would come in, and then they would all get served New York pizza. Well, to actually switch those studios would take way too long. So we come to find out as we're getting handed pizza that we didn't earn that we were, quote unquote, Willa's outside group. So she comes running in by herself, ditches all the poor people down on Times Square. Gosh only knows where the people that were in the studio were told to go. They were probably told to kindly go screw off. And we got served pizza in the TRL studio and we're on TRL. And so the same outgoing friend of mine was asked if he wouldn't mind like doing a shout out or something like that during a video. And so this guy who is like he's a 6'3" African-American dude, ended up having to do a shout out for a Sum 41 video, which was hysterical to say the least.
Wait, and so is this where they would do the thing like in the middle of the video, they would pop up a little box and be like, yo, what's up to my friends back home?
Yeah, exactly. And so if you look, and I have a videotape of this, but I don't have a VCR to play it in. If you look there in the background, there's me and a couple of friends of mine on MTV on national television in 2001 or so.
Just eating your shameful stolen pizza.
That's exactly right. And if memory serves, the pizza wasn't even that good. But still, we didn't even earn it, and yet we got to eat it.
Oh, MTV is full of lies.
Full of lies, I tell you.
Lies and pizza.
Lies and pizza.
That's a fantastic story. You better make sure to tell that to your kid, and then they'll just say, wow, what is TRL, this mythical thing that used to be on TV?
Wait, what do you mean it's like, what do you mean you videotaped it? What is a tape?
Man, are you really looking forward to when your kid asks you what you mean by tape a show?
No, I was thinking about that just the other day. That you know, our kids, one of which is on the way, will not know what a tape is. Just like everyone's been laughing about, you know, nobody knows what the save icon is really for. That's just the way it's going to be. That's the reality they're going to grow up in. I hate Skype.
Yes.
You know, the funny thing is, as soon as I hit hang up, I was presented with a Skype survey about the quality of my call.
Oh, I didn't get one this time.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah, it's peak internet time, I suppose. Everyone's getting home and firing up their whatever kids use these days, their Snapchats.
Now, are you the same age as we are, Dan, give or take a little bit?
I am 30.
Oh, okay. God. And you threw out your back already, you old man?
Oh, God, yeah. Well, you'll probably get to that story eventually in one of the episodes. Yeah, I ruined it at work setting up for a film shoot, so.
Oh, no, I that's right. I do think I heard that. Because you were carrying way too much or, like, setting up some boom or something like that that you shouldn't have done?
Yeah, I lifted a box of literal weights that go on the other end of a camera crane, and I did it wrong by myself and then put myself out for about 2 weeks. It was rad.
Yeah, I'm not sure I would describe it as rad, but whatever makes you happy.
No, I think I'm still kind of coming down off a Vicodin high from yesterday. That stuff doesn't get out of your system quick at all. I hate it so much.
See, I've never had Vicodin, but it sounds fun.
No, it's not, because you're basically dead to the world for multiple days, and you kind of like lose memories. Like, I think I did a thing, and then you check your text, and you're like, yeah, I totally talked to that person while I was half drugged up, because the drug concoction for things like massive back trauma like I had are Vicodin, Valium, and really strong ibuprofen all at the same time to knock you out for basically 12 hours at a time. So you basically just lay there while your muscles heal.
Wow. Well, that sounds interesting.
It's unpleasant.
Yay.
So kids, do your sit-ups. Make sure you have a strong core.
Mm-hmm. And lift with your knees.
Lift with your knees. Or not at all. Although in this case, I kind of re-injured myself while sleeping at a weird angle.
So when I was in college, I majored in computer engineering, which engineering is one of the typically harder majors. Well, I had a neighbor who's still a friend of mine, and he was a business major, which is typically one of the easier majors. So one day, he comes like kind of wide walking into my room, if that makes any sense. You know, I had the door open. There was nothing unreasonable for him to just kind of swing by to say hi. And he's got this like really weird look on his face. I'm like, dude, what's going on? Well, I think I just pulled my groin playing Diablo.
Wow.
I swear this is a true story. I have no idea how he did it. I don't know what he was doing, but apparently he thought at the time that he pulled his groin playing Diablo.
Yikes.
When in fact it was an actual hernia from getting too stressed out.
Probably.
See, this is why I don't game. It's too dangerous.
Yep, that's right. I agree. You never know what kind of muscle injury you're going to have.
Computer engineering. Yeah. That sounds like fun.
It was pretty awful, but it paid off in the end.
I was in that program for about a year, and then I had to bail. Couldn't do it.
Oh, I barely made it out alive. But, you know, I made it out alive, and that's all that counts in the end of the day. Mm-hmm.
So
but it was tough.
Dan, you were in computer engineering before you went to film school?
I was, yes.
Okay.
Oh, while playing lacrosse?
Uh-huh.
Oh, no wonder it didn't work.
Well, that and I really liked all the math. I just didn't like doing the math problems that took 12 pages to solve.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, vector calculus was super fun, like, to sit in the class and learn, and then just, you know, the homework was like, not, I was not having any of that.
Yep. I hear you.
But, yeah, you know, high math SATs, they, of course, I'm going to go into engineering, and I had no aptitude or interest in that.
But you guys make a similar living now, right? Because you're also a what I would call a VFX artist, which is probably, like, hugely insulting.
No.
No, that's accurate. That's what I tell people.
Oh,
because it's easier than explaining the specific thing that you're doing at the moment. It's more of a, you know, it's a broader umbrella term for the whole thing. Even when you're doing VFX stuff, you're still like scripting things, so it's, you know, involves some math stuff sometimes, and then I regret not actually taking a computer engineering course, because that would have made it easier, rather than just hopping on Stack Overflow for every little thing that I need, and then copying and pasting that, and then I have the Swiss cheese thing that I have accumulated together with all kinds of stuff, defining different things that feed into other things, and they all have different names, because I just didn't care at the time, because it was only going to be that one little thing, and then it just ballooned.
Oh, so you did go to computer engineering school then?
Yes. No. And then also, the same thing happens with, like, I don't know if you heard Dan and I talk about this before, but with compositing, you have these scripts, these scene files, where you have nodes that you arrange in a certain way, and it's basically just like a visual way of looking at a program. And so they'll do, like, certain standardized functions, and you hook them up together, and they perform whatever it is they're going to do. But oftentimes you run into the same thing where you're just like, oh, well, I just need to do this one little thing. And then, you know, sure enough, a week later, you're like, oh my God, why didn't I label any of this stuff? I don't even remember what I did. So that's always fun.
You sound pretty much like a normal developer, if you ask me.
Yeah, that's that's great.
I actually have a question to ask you when we get to the film portion of the podcast regarding the film that I selected, but we can save that for later.
We can hop right into it right now.
Let's do it. Let's get into it.
Yeah. Resort your index cards, Dan.
Yeah, all right. We kept everyone waiting for a half hour.
There we go.
All right. Let's get on to the movie.
Yes.
This week's movie, as hinted by our Twitter account, is Collateral, Michael Mann's 2004 film, starring Tom Cruise and Jamie Foxx. Dun, dun, dun.
Now, have either of you guys seen this prior to me asking you to watch it?
Absolutely.
No.
No?
No.
You didn't see this movie?
Not until this, but I heard good things.
Oh God, how did you miss this one? It was like
this was during my I don't care for Tom Cruise phase, which is still going. On.
I was about to say, did that end?
No, it kind of started with him going nuts over I think the Mission Impossible 2 or something press junket, and then just kept going. But I have to say, I now that I have seen it, I find that he was perfectly cast for this because he's a sociopath, so he does a good job. So what more
and
can
he's
you
a
ask
good
for?
Actor.
Yeah, that too, I guess. Sometimes
I have no love for Tom Cruise's psychotic real world persona, but I do enjoy. I can't think of a Tom Cruise movie I've seen that I didn't like. Now, I haven't seen anything he's done in the last couple of years, probably not since Night and Day, which was terrible, but extremely entertaining. And so for that, I enjoyed it. But everything he's ever done that I've seen, I've enjoyed.
I agree.
I saw Night and Day on a plane or something. Wow. That was something.
There's no need to highlight that one. It wasn't clearly a great movie, but Tom Cruise is a great. I mean, Tropic Thunder was a couple years before that. He was phenomenal in Tropic Thunder.
Yes. But that was not like his usual role, where he was. You know, he's basically always Tom Cruise in everything he does.
Right.
With the shark smile and the unblinking stare of peering into your soul. So, you know, it's good stuff in this particular role. And so I like him here in this. And I would say that anyone who's avoided watching it, maybe because of Tom Cruise, such as myself, should go back and watch it.
Yeah, I think you're probably the only person that would avoid a movie just because of Tom Cruise.
Well, I don't know about that. But no, I think that this did intersect with kind of the beginning of his insanity from my recollection. But I absolutely loved Collateral, and I've loved it since I saw it for the first time. And one of the things, and it's funny you bring up Tropic Thunder, one of the things that occurred to me about Collateral as I was rewatching it before we recorded was this was the first time that I can remember seeing Tom Cruise look like anything but sexy Tom Cruise, like with the gray hair and so on. Yeah. You know, whereas in Tropic Thunder, he's like, you know, bald and fat and whatnot. But in this movie, he still mostly looks like Tom Cruise, but he's gray, which I don't recall having ever seen before.
Yeah. I'm with you there.
Yeah, I remember press at the time was like, oh, what a bold move. You know, Tom Cruise with gray hair, because they were, you know, saying that it ages him. But I agree. I think that it works well in this context. And if I had seen him looking like he looks in Minority Report or in one of the Mission Impossibles or something like that, with, you know, just standard Tom Cruise appearance, then I would have been like, whatever. It doesn't really fit this grittier world. I think that it actually helps. The makeup and hair dye and everything.
And the slightly too high pants.
Yeah.
There are a few instances where his suit pants are just a little too high, but
I did not notice that.
Yeah, it's, you know, just nitpicking. But this movie lands in his career between Last Samurai and War of the Worlds, which, I mean, say what you want about Last Samurai and the story, but that's kind of good Tom Cruise acting there. And right before Last Samurai was Minority Report, so he was kind of on a roll of good performances, if you ask me. But
I liked Minority Report, and I did not like Last Samurai. And I absolutely hated War of the Worlds. It was awful.
All right, I got to write that down, because we got to talk about that on another show.
See, I did see Last Samurai, and I actually, that might be the one exception where I don't remember it fondly. I don't remember disliking it, but I don't remember particularly liking it either. And I've never seen, what was it, War of the Worlds? Is that what you said?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I never saw
the
that
Steven
one.
Spielberg epic War of the Worlds retelling.
Yeah, whatever. Now, Joe, did you or did you not end up liking Collateral?
Oh, no, I liked it. I don't want to give the impression that I didn't. I just want to say that I was surprised in, you know, since I had gone so long without seeing it, I figured that there'd be something that I was going to, you know, be able to use as a rationalization for it, like Tom Cruise, etc. And I was just like, no, I really should have seen this. Like, it was a good movie. It was well-constructed, well-shot, all the good stuff. I mean, there's nits to pick, but good film. Highly recommend.
Good. Well, I'm glad you enjoyed it. And Dan, I'm assuming that you also liked it.
Yeah, I liked it from the get-go. I believe I saw this one in theaters as well, and I liked it then, and I like it now, all for the same sort of reasons, because of Michael Mann's insanity and the way he shoots and directs. And this was also
Hold on. What do you mean by insanity? Because I know nothing about what it takes to make a movie. I assume it's just like me going and taking a movie with my iPhone. So what's insane about the way he directs?
He violates a whole lot of rules, and probably better examples of this are if you've seen, what's the one right after this?
Miami Vice. Was that
Miami
right
Vice
after this?
Was a disaster, but Public Enemy is kind of a crazy, crazy Michael Mann movie in the crazy Michael Mann way, where at least in this movie in particular, he took some digital camera technology that was not remotely usable and sort of forced some camera vendors to kind of tear them apart and put them back together. And this sort of thing happens at all kinds of levels on film sets. You know, they demand things to be custom made for their film. But this is the first time where he kind of said, I could give a crap about like how much noise is in the image. Like, I want to be able to see the skyline at night in LA without having lights. And that's not really a thing that you do. And he kind of, well, you can kind of read between the lines some of the, I was reading the American Cinematographer retelling of this, and his director of photography was departed after creative differences 3 weeks into the film, and then the chief lighting technician shortly thereafter was replaced, and he was doing some very odd things with cameras and lights that are not the kind of thing you do on a giant movie like this.
Well, it's funny you bring that up, because What I wanted to ask you guys about was kind of related to the cameras in the film and whatnot, because I remember after having seen the movie for the first time, which I think might have been at home, but either way, I looked into, as I always do, like the IMDb page and the Wikipedia page, and I had read, and I remember having read, that he used like some crazy camera technology. I think predominantly it was digital. Or my understanding of it was that the fact that it was digital was really weird at the time. And this was what, like 2004, I think? Something like that?
And, very much so, yeah.
And so I guess that's what made it kind of visually unique. And as I was rewatching it, I was trying to figure out, okay, well, in a lot of cases, I thought it looked like almost every other movie I'd ever seen. It, just in terms of like picture quality and I'm going to use non-technical terms, but like the warmth of the image. And especially when he was in, when there were pictures in the cab or portions in the cab, that looked normal to me, but it was the exterior shots that looked kind of grainy almost, but not in a noisy, I guess is a better word for it, because it's not that it looked like it was pixelated or something like that. It just didn't look as crisp, but I almost feel like that works for the kind of environment that the movie was supposed to be in that the movie is kind of gritty and not crisp. And the question I wanted to ask you guys is, how does shooting in digital work for future formats? So my limited understanding is if you film a movie with actual film and the going and DVDs of the day are standard definition. Well, in the future, suddenly Blu-rays are a thing. And my limited understanding is you can just take those original pieces of film and rescan them at 1080p. And now you have a Blu-ray, and you could do it again at 4K to some reasonable limit. How does that work with this movie, which was filmed, I would assume, during the pre-HD days, question mark? How do they get a 4K exposure out of this? Is that where you two come in to digitally fill things in? Like, how does that work?
Should I take this one, or you want to take this one, Jeff?
Well, does the question make sense? Let me start there.
Yeah. I think what you're talking about is the future-proofing of the format. There is something to be said for that. This one was shot on a camera that wasn't used often called the Thompson Viper, as well as some Sony Cine Alta cameras, which were used on Star Wars Episode One, I think. But everything outside was shot digitally, and everything inside was shot on film because they had more control over that. And Michael Mann talks about how he really wanted to see the city as kind of part of his overarching character story here, that this really takes place in LA and it's a very important thing. But these cameras shoot 1080p, so there will never be a, well, one of them shoots 1080i, but that's a different story. There will never be a 4K version of this movie. It's not possible. But you are correct in saying that when they go back, if they want to make a 4K version of a film, they will rescan the film at a higher resolution. Sometimes they will just do a 2K blow up. We talked about that on one of these episodes. We were talking about why you shouldn't buy a 4K TV, because most of these, even if shot on film, film resolves to around 3.2K. And please don't email me, people. So even the best film is not quite 4K. You can scan it at 4K, but you're not going to get anything extra out of it. But you can't really go higher than the 2K. So most people don't go higher than 2K, even for film stuff. So this one in particular, yeah. And then some of the other things, like on the digital cameras, these were very early cameras that didn't take the same lenses as film cameras. So they were like, God, I don't even know. They're slightly better than news style lenses, which is why if you look in the background of some of the car scenes, there's a lot of like blown out streetlights that look really hazy and weird. And they do all kinds of things with just amping up the gain on these things, which is a really bad thing to do on digital cameras. If you've ever just gone into Photoshop and just yanked the brightness up or down, even in just iPhoto or whatever, you see all that noise come through. They're basically doing that in camera on a lot of these things. So he did a lot of mean things to these cameras, but that was the look he wanted. They had a very thin threshold of where they wanted to keep the noise off the people's faces. So that's what most of the director of photography was talking about in this article that I read about, how they pumped a whole bunch of light into the actors' faces so the backgrounds can still be noisy, but the people don't look distracting.
I got to ask a question, though, because I honestly don't know as much about cameras as you do, and especially in regards to this movie. Did they do any kind of noise reduction on this? Because it looked a little too smooth in some parts when I was watching the iTunes version of this. But I don't know if that's part of the fact that I was watching the streamed iTunes version or if that was they had gone back in and done some actual like smoothing to this.
It wouldn't surprise me. It did go through a digital intermediate at Company 3, and they're a great company that does color correction and all that fun stuff. So I imagine they probably did some. Again, I think they mostly focused on the faces, because the way they described it, they could give a crap about the background. They were just really excited, this being the first time using digital like this, that you could see like the silhouettes of the trees and the palm trees against the sky at nighttime. They talk about that over and over again. They were clearly enamored with the digital technology, but they were focused on bringing, overlighting the people so they could bring them down in post. And I assume they put some sort of cleanup on that noise as well. But, you know, it's still pretty damn noisy, as I'm sure you saw.
Yeah, but I mean, it lends a certain something to it, almost like movies that are shot on VHS, where it's peculiar. And it can throw you out of it if you're thinking about it too much, but I think they did a good job here balancing that. So you don't usually think about it, except sometimes when they move, it's a little too smooth or...
Oh, that smoothness. Okay, I know what you're talking about. This is another area where Michael Mann is insane, because...
Wait, he didn't do like a pull down on this. This isn't like shot at 30, is it?
No, not only...
Oh, slow down. What does that question even mean?
Digital cameras before a certain year shot at 30 frames a second. They were just built that way, and mm-hmm. film is shot at 24 frames a second.
Okay.
And there's something called 3:2 pull down to convert from one to the other, but it leaves all kinds of artifacting.
I gotcha.
What Michael Mann did is he wants to get the most exposure out of his camera, and for film cameras, you got 180 degrees of a shutter. So when the film is being exposed for 1/24th of a second, it's only getting light for half of that. So this mirror spins, it gets light for 1/48th of a second, dark for 1/48th of a second, then advances, because it can't advance while light is hitting it, or it'll streak. So, did that make any sense at all?
Yep.
Okay. So in digital cameras, they're not actually moving film, so it doesn't really matter. So you can crank your shutter up to about 360 degrees, which makes it look like video-y, even though it's still running at 24 frames a second. So in many instances in this film, he's running at higher than 180 degree shutter, which makes everything look smeary and video-y and terrible, which he did, I think, for the entire movie of Miami Vice, which is another reason that movie looks ridiculous.
Yeah, I have to say... Miami Vice not only is ridiculous, but does look ridiculous. And I think that it was a little more, even after you saying all of the stuff, I think this was a little more restrained in a way than Miami Vice was, because that was a little bit more of a outlandish action movie than this was.
Yeah, it helps that half of the movie was, well, it's probably less than half. The indoor stuff was shot on film, and you can't go higher than 180 there. And they had more control over the lighting in the car setup, so they probably shot 180 degree shutter there. There's a reason going beyond 180 degree shutter is called shutter crime. It's because it's a thing you don't do. It's just, it's bad taste, and it's something that if you tell a good cinematographer to do that, they'll probably quit, like happened in this movie.
So when you say he was insane, it sounds to me that he was insane because of technical reasons, or is it also his choices in the way he like frames shots and does, I don't know, some of the soft things, for lack of a better way of describing it? Like, is it both, or is it just his technical choices?
I think the technical choices are mostly where he lost his mind, because, I mean, the reason you would do some of these things with trying experimental cameras and gain them up and all this crazy stuff to get an image that you're really into are not the kind of things that somebody gets away with usually on a $65 million movie. So, you know, there's some discussion in the article about how the studio was super freaked out and required them to record to two separate devices at the same time in case one of these prototype things failed, which, you know, even at doing that, you're just recording garbage coming through these cameras sometimes. So they were, you know, half the time you couldn't see what was coming through the camera. They're talking about in these anamorphic lenses on these cameras, they squeeze the image, so it's everything looks squished by 50% in lengthwise, in half. But to unsqueeze it while you were watching it through the viewfinder would create a delay between the audio and the video, so they turned that off. So they were looking at an image that was completely squished, and they couldn't tell what the hell was going on, just so they could maintain focus. Like, these are not the kind of hacks that you really want to take chances on in a $65 million movie, but Michael Mann, being who he is, they let him do his thing, and I think it turned out pretty well, but there are a lot of instances where the cinematography isn't necessarily beautiful, but it works for his story, and that's really all that matters, I guess. But no, in terms of his directing style and choices, I thought it was great. I don't find any issue with that.
Fair enough.
Yeah, and Casey, I have to ask you, we probably should have asked this at the beginning, but what is it about the movie that speaks to you? Because I don't think it's the technical stuff that speaks to you about the film. Is it some sort of an emotional response to the characters, or you just thought the story was badass, or what was it?
I don't know. I had a feeling you were going to ask me something about like this, and I was thinking as I was watching the movie, why do I like this movie so much? And I can't put my finger on like a specific thing that I just thought was awesome. I just felt that it was a different kind of story. It seems like Hollywood likes to go in waves where they just regurgitate things they've done 18 times, and then they'll come up with a couple of interesting things and then regurgitate those 18 times. And this was one of those instances where, to me, I thought it was a different and clever story. As someone who tends to mind his own business when going about daily life, I, to some degree, could sympathize with Jamie Foxx's character. Like, what would it be like to have this psychopath in the back of your cab going around and compelling to you to be his, like, wingman as he kills all these people? And I never really enjoyed Shoot. Was it Crash, which was some, like, drug-related movie where there were, like, 13 interrelated stories? It doesn't matter. It was that, like, Love Actually was kind of sort of the same way, if you want to go from, like, gritty, drama to completely ridiculous romantic comedy. But anyways, these like intertwined stories between like Jada Pinkett Smith and Jamie Foxx and Tom Cruise and all of these different like tangents and whatnot. And the way all of it was done, I just thought was very cool. And I also thought the dialogue was really well written. Like, let me say, I took some notes. One of my favorite lines in the world, which I use on a regular basis, and thankfully nobody calls me out on, dude, you heard that in Collateral. Tom Cruise at the very end, spoiler alert, when he's chasing after Jamie Foxx, he says, "Max, I do this for a living," which is like such a sweet line, because in those just few words, he's saying everything there is that needed to be said. Like, you are a dead man. This is what I do. Like, little quips like that, I just think were so good. And like the jazz scene where Tom Cruise kind of realizes, you know, the easiest way to get Jamie Foxx to follow along and do what he wants to do is to tell Max, Jamie Foxx, "Well, we're ahead of schedule. Let's go catch a little bit of jazz." And then it turns out he's on the next stop. I don't know. Maybe I'm easily entertained. I am easily entertained, but stuff like that, I just thought was really well done. Does that sort of kind of answer the question?
Oh yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's totally acceptable. I came away from the movie feeling differently about certain things. I mean, I liked it, but I haven't processed it in that particular way, but I can see all those things. They all speak to me. Especially the idea of this guy being put upon hoping that it's just going to be a little bit more and then it won't be so bad. Like, it'll all just sort of be fine in the end. And there is, of course, spoiler alert, that breaking point where things are not fine and he comes to realize that things are just going to keep going downhill and he needs to actually do something about it himself rather than just be a party that gets dragged along from place to place and does whatever this other person says to do. That at some point he stops being the victim in this film, which I thought was interesting. It's, you know, not uncommon in film, but here I thought it was especially interesting. Dan?
Yeah, that theme is in this movie in a couple different forms. There's it's kind of like a Back to Work episode where Tom Cruise is schooling him from the back seat saying, you know, you're procrastinating with your limo service. Everything's got to be perfect before you even start, when all it would take is a down payment and, you know, start to follow your dream and you'll get there, but you're too scared of it. And then, you know, eventually he takes charge of his own life and moves forward. But that's Jamie Foxx's story. And, you know, he comes out with the girl at the end too, because why not?
I do have to say, though, when I was watching it, this being my first time, of course I recognized Jada Pinkett Smith in the movie, and I was just like, so she's just going to leave the cab, huh? And that's it. We're not going to see her again. Right. she won't figure into this movie at all, ever again.
No. Yeah, I hear you.
I think when I first saw this, this was one of the first movies where I really started to, I don't want to say take him seriously, but this is the first time I saw Jamie Foxx in a movie where I was like, yeah, this guy is going places, and he's going to be in a bunch more films, because he hadn't done a whole lot up until then, at least to catch my attention.
Yeah, I agree. Absolutely. I don't know. The other thing I liked about Collateral was that I tend to consume media on a very surface level. I was terrible in English class because, you know, English teachers always wanted to know the symbolism behind everything. And I just, I don't think about those sorts of things. When I listen to music, I very rarely pay attention to lyrics. I don't know why. It's just the way I am. And in this movie, I feel like I did catch a little bit of the subtlety, or maybe I'm making this up, but I felt like I caught it. And a great example of this is when Tom Cruise, I think it was early on when they're in the cab together, he asks Jamie Foxx, you know, what other things are you putting together? And you see Jamie Foxx looking in the rearview mirror and kind of mulling it over. Like, do I want to tell this guy? No. And he just says, oh, you know, I'm just working on some stuff. And like some of that subtlety where you can see like him evaluating whether or not Tom Cruise is worth it and kind of making a decision already that Tom Cruise is bad news. I don't know. Stuff like that, I actually picked up in this movie, which is very rare for me to catch that kind of subtlety or unspoken communication. And I, like I said before, I still think the dialogue was really, really good. And I'm trying to think of other examples of it. I wrote some down, but none of them are particularly noteworthy out of context. So when the dude Peter pans out the window and hits the cab, and Jamie Foxx says, he's dead. And Tom Cruise, totally deadpan, good guess. You know, like stuff like that. I don't know. And like, oh, you killed him. No, I didn't kill him. The bullets in the fall killed him. I just shot him. You know, stupid stuff like that. Like, you could take that in one level to be just cheesy, stupid dialogue, but I totally ate it up.
And the reason you did is because of the way it was directed and performed. Like, yeah, if somebody were to, you know, lock eyes with the camera and say, you know, bullets in the fall killed him, I just shot him, it could be a super cheesy moment, but
right.
There's a way in this movie that the characters are believable and they sort of deliver things as if they were actually in that situation. And you got to give directorial and performance credit for that. But this whole film has, I don't want to say it feels like a small world, but it's not all expansive in its scope. Like it has a world, it has a story. They're very specific and they're very isolated from everyone else. Like this is Jamie Foxx's story in LA. He's this cab driver in LA and he's doing his thing. And this is what happens to him. And it all takes place in that world. We don't break from the world of this film at any given point. And we stay there and we learn as much about these people as we possibly can. And it really just draws you in. And a lot of that is these characters. Like you come to understand that Tom Cruise is psychotic and his character came from God knows where. I mean, they do a little bit of on the nose hinting at, you know, these cartels hiring former special forces guys to do their bidding. And, you know, they throw in that little quick story from Mark Ruffalo, by the way. I totally forgot that was Mark Ruffalo in this character.
Yeah,
I saw
yeah, yeah.
But where he does his little spiel about how this happened back in, you know, was it Seattle or something? Where
I thought it was Oakland.
Oakland, that's what it was. Yeah. Well, you know, those hard streets of Seattle. I mix it up with Oakland. But the characters were all like real people and they were great performances, I thought.
I agree. The other thing I wanted to ask you guys is when Jamie Foxx goes in to meet Felix, to meet Javier Bardem or however you pronounce his name. And the first thing that Felix says upon seeing Jamie Foxx is, I thought you'd be taller. Is that like a masked Tom Cruise joke? Or because I didn't catch that until this last time that I watched it. And I've probably seen this movie like 20 or 30 times. And I heard him say that and I was like, is that a Tom Cruise joke? I don't know. Maybe it's not, but I thought it was funny.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, what else would you say to somebody who's supposed to be this crazed assassin?
Like ruthless killer. Yeah, yeah.
You certainly don't expect him to look like Jamie Foxx wearing a little hoodie and glasses.
Yeah, seriously.
But he does a great job in that scene of sort of turning around and playing his part and threatening that guy who was standing behind him.
Yep, yep. And I loved how he used the glasses as like dramatic effect as well. Like he took them off to be like super badass and then eventually puts them on, you know, again, to show how serious he is about everything. And again, to your point earlier, that could be so cheesy. But because Jamie Foxx sold it so well and because it was directed so well, it was, I don't know if intense is the right word, but it made sense in context. Instead of, if it went totally wrong, it would have taken us right out of that moment and we would have been like, come on, really?
Yeah. Yeah. And you can even see in Jamie Foxx's performance, there's something underneath it where you can tell, well, or at least we, the audience, can tell that that's not genuine. And he's fighting to do that, but he's still, he's pulling it out because he has to. And then, you know, the genuine character moments, the one that I love in that scene is the very end where he's got his flash drive and he says, you know, Daniel says he was sorry and he walks off, you know, talking about the jazz man. And Javier Bardem kind of mutters something to himself because you can tell, again, he's a character and he probably doesn't want all of these people to have to be killed, but he's, you know, he's going to do what he's got to do to avoid being indicted. So you see the conflict on him, a guy that by all accounts we're supposed to hate, he's the bad guy of this movie, but you see a little bit of that conflict in him, just the way he's like pseudo flustered and kind of adjusting himself after he hears that line. And he's like, damn, that was a human moment right there that made this whole scene just end on a great line.
Yeah, I think one of the things that I liked about it was it didn't feel like there was any fluff, and not in the way that like a director zooms in on something that is going to become important later, you know, where everything feels so deliberate. It's like, okay, well, obvious. Well, like Jada Pinkett is a great example. You know, if having Jada Pinkett in the beginning of the movie, you know, she's going to come around later. And there's that kind of like lack of fluff, which is annoying because it's obvious. But so much of this movie, it didn't have filler. It didn't have any moments that I could think of where if they were taken out of the movie would have been just as good or better. If any of these moments were taken away, in my personal opinion, it would have been worse and it wouldn't have made it as good a film.
I will say, I mean, there could have been some tightening with some of the stuff, but...
So like what? Because I'd be curious to hear what I'm missing in that regard.
I don't mean that you're missing any. I mean, it's probably a matter of personal taste. It's just that, like when they have the scene at the gas station, of course he needs to have a scene where he explains that if he tries to get away, bad stuff will happen to people, like it did to the West Hollywood gang that tried to take his wallet and briefcase. But at the same time, that scene kind of was a little longish and could have happened inside of the car. I know I get the feeling that they kind of wanted to do it just to have another location. Like with the jazz, like it's important that they established the jazz music for as long as it was on screen, because you don't want to just rush into it, especially since jazz was such an important part of the interrogation sort of that goes on afterwards, the conversation that they have. Maybe just a couple trimming things here and there, but I otherwise, I mean, I'm just talking about like seconds here or there or whatever.
No, that's fair.
I think it's fine.
I think that's fair.
And but while you brought up, you know, when Jada Pinkett Smith, when you see her, you're like, oh, she'll come back. There were some other relatively large names that they had come into this movie that didn't wind up doing anything, which was fine because it kind of threw you off a little bit. Like, I joked that you could tell that something was going to happen with Jada Pinkett Smith, of course, but like Debbie Mazar, like, nothing happened with her. And then Jason Statham at the airport.
Yep. Right.
Like,
yep.
He was insignificant. These are, you know, relatively large names that you would expect to do something inside of the film. So having them in there kind of does, I guess, throw you off the trail a little bit, if you're expecting them to come back later, like Jada Pinkett comes back later. Like, you don't wind up seeing them again.
Yeah. But there were a couple other moments, like particularly Mark Ruffalo, Peter Berg, and Bruce McGill as the FBI guy. Their whole storyline could have seemed incredibly contrived, where they were forced in to sort of add this additional context to, you know, trying to track down not only Tom Cruise in this situation, but linking it to the other ones, and eventually, obviously, linking it back to Jada Pinkett. But I thought they did a great job with the little amount of screen time they had to sort of explain their part in the story and push the story forward. Like, he does a great job, Michael Mann, in this movie of adding tension to the story with every additional scene. And, you know, when the FBI and Mark Ruffalo are first talking, you're like, okay, they're going to exchange some information here. Maybe that'll put a little pressure on them. But then right then and there they go, boom, I see that cab. It's got a broken roof. And then they start to connect the dots. And it's like, we're all going to meet up at this club at the exact same time. And it's like, great, it's on now. This is going to be insane. And just the tension building up when they're moving through that club at Fever, or whatever that was the name of it. Yeah, it's just,
yep.
I thought it was a great way of bringing all of these stories together, like literally in one place and seeing it play out. And that was a hell of a scene.
Absolutely. Now, Joe, you live nearish to Los Angeles. So did you recognize a lot of these locations or not at all?
I mean, I recognize some of the locations. The thing that I recognized more was the times that they were not really going the places that they said they were going. It seemed
that, yeah.
Yeah, it seemed that Michael Mann wanted to focus more on visually impressive shots than what was written in the script. Like what was written in the script for the most part made sense. Like we're going to go over to Fountain in West Hollywood. Fountain West Hollywood, sure, fine. 17 minutes. I will say that the writer probably had that wrong from where they were downtown, but then they go there, but that's not really West Hollywood what they shot. It didn't seem to me to be any place that I've ever seen. When they're going to Washington and Pico, they're like driving through some factory area, and it was just sort of baffling.
It took a detour down past the airport.
Yes, back down past the airport and then back up again, just to throw everybody off their tail. So there's some stuff in there that doesn't like make a whole bunch of sense. But if you're not that familiar with Los Angeles, you're totally fine watching this movie. Like, it's not going to kick you out of it unless you're thinking about those things. And like with the subway, that wouldn't be running at the hour that they were using it at. It just doesn't run then, but it's fine. I mean, it works in the film. So, you know, it's all fine. Just don't actually look up any of the stuff and then expect it to make sense based on what you're seeing. It just go along for the ride.
Yeah, because the train also doesn't really go places that you would want to go, does it?
Well, I mean, it says on the MTA signage in there that it's going to Long Beach, which is true. There's the line that runs to Long Beach from downtown. But like I said, it shouldn't have been running at the hour that I think that they were awake at, based on everything else that had happened in the film.
Yeah, I asked because, you know, I live not too far from Washington, D.C., and so I have some friends in D.C. who have watched House of Cards, and of course, D.C. being probably almost as bad as Los Angeles traffic-wise, they're always like, oh, God, there's no freaking way that would happen. That's totally wrong. It's totally inaccurate. And they get all up in arms about it. And I was curious, you know, it sounds like, for the most part, they were at least within reason of, within reach of reality, generally speaking. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I mean, there's a... What was it? When he gets pulled over for the broken windshield, mm-hmm. And they interrogate him, you know, about how his windshield got broken, and he makes up that story about a deer hitting his car. And of course, the cop makes the joke, oh, a South Central deer hit your car because of where he said he was. Even in the script, whoever wrote it knew enough to know that a deer should not have been there. That works out fine. But it was just some of the other things, like I said, that don't necessarily work out. It's more of a crime in, like, when you're watching things that are made in a less interesting way than this, where you're really distracted by where they're going and what they're doing.
Yeah, if you're paying attention to the street signs in this movie, the director has failed.
Yeah, I gotta say, like, you know, Arrested Development is really bad at this. When they were made, they're supposed to be in Orange County, but everything was shot in Culver City. So if you look around, everything's in Culver City, but you wouldn't know that unless you'd actually been in Culver City in Orange County. You wouldn't be able to tell that apart. That wouldn't make any sense to you. So just like with this movie, it's like, if you haven't been in these places, then what's happening in the film won't negatively impact what you're watching. So it's fine.
Yeah, and for your House of Cards friends, you can tell them that wouldn't happen in D.C. because they shot in Maryland.
I thought it was somewhere near-ish to D.C., but not actually D.C., so yeah, that makes sense. And the funny thing about Collateral is a lot of the places they name-dropped, I can't think of any off the top of my head other than like South Central. Those are places that even someone who's lived on the East Coast his entire life, like I recognized some of those places from other movies and popular media and stuff like that. Not every single one, of course, but a lot of them, I was like, oh yeah, I know that's somewhere in the greater LA area. So that makes sense to me.
And I love how in the beginning with Jada Pinkett in the backseat, they're arguing over cab routes and they're just rattling off streets just like the SNL skit, of course, or like everyone in California has to do, argue about which way is the best way to get where you're going. Adds the authenticity to the California experience.
Yes. And the freeway naming, because we're apparently the only place that puts the in front of the freeway name.
That's not true.
Okay.
We do that here too.
But anyway. Okay. Well, where I'm from in Florida, it was I-275 and I-4 and all that stuff. And then over here, it's you wouldn't call it I-10. You'd call it the 10 or the 101. And there's a funny moment in 30 Rock where Liz Lemon is in Los Angeles and she's asking for directions to I-10 and someone shouts at her, "You mean the 10?" And then they cut back from that. Because it's just one of those quirks. So of course they captured it in the movie, but I wouldn't expect any less since it was shot in LA. It wasn't like Toronto for LA or something like that, which some movies have done.
One thing I really liked about this movie is the pacing and the editing, but more specifically the way they used music in this movie. There was some great music selections that were very at odds with each other if you look at all of them together, but the way they're played and when they're played really add to the feeling of this movie, just in the same way that his crazy gained up cameras really worked out when they're driving around.
Yeah, I was thinking the same thing. Like, I can never hear the Audioslave song, Staring at the Sun or something like that. I forget the name of it. But the one that's played when the coyote runs across the road, which actually, speaking of not getting symbolism, I never quite understood the point of that scene, actually. Like, what was the point of that coyote scene?
Well, I'm going to guess, just from the way it was shot, that we're supposed to associate Vincent with the coyote. Because they just keep cutting back and forth between Vincent and the coyote staring at one another. But that seems a little literal. So maybe there's some other subtext that I missed. But
it could be the wild animal roaming the streets of Los Angeles. I mean,
also another situation where there wouldn't really be a coyote in Koreatown, but whatever. Moving on.
It very well may be something as simple as just... this ridiculous thing that never happens. It's just like, how did you end up here and what is going on? This completely out of the ordinary situation where you've got this crazy man in the backseat is going to kill you.
Yeah, that's fair. But anyway, I interrupted myself in saying that I can't hear Staring at the Sun or whatever that Audioslave song is without thinking of that scene that I otherwise don't understand. And I completely agree with you. In fact, one of the things I was thinking about last night when I was watching it was there's something special about the music, but when I went to take a note to talk about it, I couldn't figure out what made it special. And I think you hit the nail on the head, Dan, that it's like completely eclectic and nothing matches with anything else. Yet somehow it just all feels kind of right in the particular scene in which any of these songs is.
Well, I mean, like the scoring in the film is also atmospheric more than, you know, there's no big bombastic, like crazy. It's like, it's not Transformers or something like that. There's nothing, nothing forceful in this score, like blasting at the speakers at you. What's in there to fill these scenes is often just sort of like a background ambient sort of thing that just carries you through. And I didn't look at who did it, but it's kind of like the kind of thing. It's James Newton Howard. That makes sense. It's kind of like the same thing that Clint Mansell does or something like that, or James Newton Howard, where it's just sort of very ambient and adds an atmosphere to the movie. It doesn't necessarily sound like it's from a place or a time, but fills in sort of what would otherwise be a gap, I guess. Because there's a lot of stuff where they're driving around and not talking, so that you need something there.
Yeah, there was only one moment where the score felt really kind of contrived to me. That's when after Jamie Foxx wrecks the cab and the cop is looking around through the wreckage and he notices the dead body in the trunk and it does that turn into dun dun dun. You're just like, you can hear it go, uh-oh, you're in trouble now. But yeah. Other than that, yeah, just the atmospherics and I don't know, just the tone of everything combined just made a really great feeling movie. And it felt, I mean, that's, you know, when movies are done right, the combination of the acting and the visuals and the sound, they become bigger than themselves. And it's a great cinematic feeling. And I think they did a great job of that.
So, Joe, if you were to pick some nits, what would you say about the movie that you haven't said already that you didn't particularly care for?
Oh, I think I've said most of it already. But now that Dan brought up the cop scene, that it did kind of throw me a little bit that he couldn't trust the cop enough in that situation, that he suddenly became so gung-ho and took charge right at that moment. Like, if the cop hadn't been there, if he had just decided to take matters into his own hands, then I could have probably gone along with that a little more than seeing him resist the cop and then take a gun and wield it at a cop and then make off with the weapon to go do the thing where he saves her all by himself. That would be my nit.
I think the reason that I allowed it in my head was that it's not that he didn't necessarily trust the cop. It's that there was an unbelievable urgency. And because of that, all bets were off and he just needed to get to Jada as quickly as possible. And to sit there and try to explain to the cop, no, you don't understand, that I didn't put that dead body back there. Well, I did, but it was really because somebody made me. And it just, he didn't have time for any of that. And so he just thought the best way to take care of this is to subdue the cop and go about my business. And I did think another great, like, very quick line that was really funny was when he like ties up the cop. He says, I'm going to blah, 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 call the cops. He is a cop and you just tied him up. What the hell is he supposed to do? I just thought that was hysterical.
Yeah. Well, and, but see, the thing that undermines the urgency though, is that he goes, runs to the top of a parking garage that's near where he needs to be. But that just sets up a shot, so that when they do the over the shoulder where they rack focus between Tom Cruise and him on the top of the parking garage, like that's the whole reason why he ran to the top of the parking garage, right, was just right. So they could have that shot.
That's not why. Remember, he was trying to dial and he didn't have any signal, and so he had to get up high.
Remember uh-huh. that? Remember when that was a thing?
Flip phones.
Yeah, actually, and it's funny to bring that up. The one thing that I think really took me out of this movie when I watched it last night, and again, I love this movie, I've seen it a zillion times, was seeing like the ancient tablet that Tom Cruise was using, and then the tablet in the cab, and the flip phone. And I understand there's nothing they can do to, you know, plan for the future. Nobody knew in 3 or 4 years there was going to be an iPhone, but it's just so vastly different than today. Like, the cars actually are not that different from today, but the technology is so different from today. There were a couple times that I was just like getting whiplash looking at this old ass equipment that we haven't seen in 10 years.
Yeah. Nowadays, Jamie Foxx would throw his iPad off the bridge and he would drive him to an Apple store and just log into iCloud and get his backup of his Pages document.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, that's so true.
Now that you mention that, there was the taxi computer was running like XP or something, which totally makes sense today still. Just the way that it was able to be used as a thumb drive internet browser thing just at the drop of a hat seemed a little peculiar, but you know, they didn't dwell on it for very long. It just needed to happen so that they could move on to the next part of the story, which is fine.
You doubt the credibility of the pre-installed decryption software on his taxicab computer?
Yeah, and the fact that they leave web browsers running for taxicab operators to just, you know, check and see what's on LiveJournal. I'm trying to remember what was 2004 social network. Yeah, right. LiveJournal, I guess, and MySpace.
Cab chat.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, I didn't have a whole lot of problems with the issues at the end there, especially because, I mean, they tried to squish it all together. So he's getting arrested by this cop. There's no way he can explain everything that's happened up until now. He's already got one cuff on him, so there's no way he has the ability to explain even if he wanted to. And that's the moment where he notices that the last target is Jada. So he's like, no way this is happening. Gotta go right now. But yeah, then the cell phone dying and the chasing them around thing, it was all a little silly. And then, you know, Tom Cruise taking an axe to one pipe in the electrical room of that building, taking out everything. Okay, I get that you need a plot point there, but that's not how buildings work.
Yeah, and sort of kind of speaking of, a couple of things. Firstly, did Tom Cruise, when he looked at the visor to read Jada Pinkett's business card, did he not realize that that was his target? And I would assume, like, if he realized it, didn't he see where this was going to end up? He just seems so cavalier and nonchalant about it. And secondly, when Tom Cruise is chasing after Max just shot him, and he, like, throws a chair through the glass and then jumps through the glass and accidentally, or it seems to me, accidentally lands on the chair and then slips. Did that strike you as completely unintentional, or do you think that was deliberate?
It was totally unintentional. That's that stuntman ate it so hard, you can tell.
Poor guy. I thought it was hysterical.
Yeah. I mean, it was real.
Yeah, happened. Yeah, absolutely.
But yeah, I mean, there were a couple moments in that scene where he's, you know, he's got the magical thinking to know two steps ahead everywhere Jamie's going. So he ran downstairs to the trains instead of outside to the street. But, you know, who's to say he didn't, maybe he just didn't flip to the last page of his PDF when he was looking through his hits and didn't know that that's where they were going.
Yeah, but that's where he came out of in the very beginning, because I thought that was kind of how this all got set up, was he was going to get Jada in the very, very beginning. And she wasn't there yet because she and Max hadn't arrived yet. So he's coming out of Jada, Vincent is coming out of Jada's building after, as Jada's going into her building. And I always filled that in as he just got there too early and was going to have to loop back around at the end of the night.
Yeah, I hadn't put that together. I was thinking about that again this time. And I was wondering, maybe since they show him like looking at his watch in a parking garage, like maybe he was setting up his way out for later. So he would stash a car and stuff there or something. And then he would just make a quick getaway that way. But that was never fully explained as to why he started there and was leaving there, unless apparently the airport is directly next to her building.
It is not.
Yeah, it is not.
But, I mean, there's a subway line there that'll take you towards Long Beach, and there's a line that runs near the airport but doesn't actually touch the airport, because that would make the cab drivers upset. So you have to take a cab or a shuttle from the airport to that part of the line and then back over. Anyway, that doesn't matter. But yeah, I did notice that at the beginning of the movie, like, he seems to turn towards her on the escalator. And what I read that as was that he had seen her, had observed her. It didn't read like a near miss, like, oh, well, didn't see her yet, I'll come back later. So maybe he always knew he had to wind up back there at the end. And it was only about the guy that was in fever. That was the part that he didn't know. That maybe that was the only reason he had to go get the USB thumb drive. I'm uncertain on that one.
Yeah.
Something I find interesting about this movie is we've been talking about how much we like the writing, and I agree, but I can't find anything else that this writer has done that I enjoy. I mean, at least on this level. He's got all four of the Pirates of the Caribbean movies, G.I. Joe, Rise of the Cobra, 30 Days of Night, Derailed.
You didn't like The Protector?
The what?
The Protector.
I don't know what that is.
Oh, well, never mind.
I, Frankenstein, he both wrote and directed.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, boy. Tomorrow When the World Began, I don't know what that is. Australia.
Punisher Warzone was supposed to be a good movie.
Wait, was it?
I don't know. I didn't see it.
Which writer are you talking about? I see written by Rick Garcia, Rene Reyes, and Cisco de Luna.
Whose page am I on? I'm on Stuart.
Stuart Beatty. He got the written by on Wikipedia.
But, oh, I'm an idiot. I'm an idiot. I was looking at soundtracks. Sorry. Carry on.
Yeah. I got to give this guy credit. He did some... He wrote a great movie here. I'm just not sure how this fits in with the rest of his movies.
Yeah, looking at this, I tend to agree. I've either seen it and thought it was mostly unremarkable or haven't seen it. Oh, well. I'm just thrilled that the three of us agreed on this, since we've disagreed on nearly everything else so far.
Exciting.
It is a Christmas miracle.
Yeah. This movie is a weird combination of a bunch of strange things that you might not imagine working, especially, again, the only way I can describe Michael Mann is a crazy person, just with some of the things he does in his movies. But this movie came out perfect. I can't think of a better version of this movie or something I wish they would have done differently.
Yeah, I agree. Just like everything in the Firefly and Serenity universe. Right, Joe?
Casey. You're outnumbered. You're outvoted.
I know. I really shouldn't pick this fight.
Yeah.
Any final thoughts, gentlemen?
Nope.
I think I'm good.
I liked it. Thank you for recommending it, Casey, and giving me a reason to watch it, because otherwise I would have just kept on skipping by this one. So congratulations.
Hey.
You've changed my mind on something.
That's exciting. I'm glad for that. Yeah, I was trying to think, you know, when you had asked me, I forget how you phrased it, but something like, you know, what's a movie that you really, really like? And, you know, there's a lot that I really like that you've seen and or I'm scared for you to see, such as, you know, Serenity, such as The Avengers. And I was trying to think of something that's slightly esoteric that maybe you would probably like, both of you actually, that would probably like, but maybe haven't seen. And so this is what I came up with. The other option I had was Hunt for October, which I freaking love, but I'm one of a very small group. And so I'm glad I chose Collateral. I think that was the wise choice.
I love Hunt for Red October too. It hasn't aged particularly well.
You're dead to me.
And it can be a little distracting to watch if someone has never seen it before, and then they go to watch it now. It can be hard to get into the mindset of the time back then, but I'd seen it in the 90s, so it was totally fine. I like that movie as well.
Now, have you seen that one, Dan?
I know I have, but it's been so long since I've seen it that I can't express any feelings about it.
Well, and you know what? Come to think of it, maybe this is a nice closing thought. Hunt for October, to me, is very similar to Collateral insofar as if you look at the facts, like, in Hunt for October, nothing happens on screen. It's all in your head. And then they show like small clips of subs like driving around, but really all the action's in your head. And in Collateral, I think so much of the conflict is in your head. And so both of these films, on paper, it just doesn't seem like they should work. And yet I think both of them worked phenomenally well. And maybe that's the common thread between them and why I like them both so darn much.
Yeah, there's a lot of internal struggle, a lot of morality, a lot of what do I do to risk myself to save other people potentially? Or, you know,
yeah,
how do I just best not get shot by Tom Cruise? Because, well, I mean, the whole movie through, I mean, we've been led to believe that he's going to use him the way he did in Oakland, and he's going to use him to drive him around, and then he's going to kill him at the end of the night anyway. So right. We know that's coming.
Right. And frame his corpse. I will say that I don't necessarily 100% agree on the two things being exactly the same. I will say that I agree that there's a certain kind of movie where there is a lot that happens inside of your head, where you're inferring things from the way a character looks at another character, certain things unfold on screen that aren't mentioned or explicitly happen as action, that can provide a different view of the world to yourself as an audience member than the movies that we're usually used to seeing nowadays, where everything is very explicit, very on screen. If someone feels a certain way, they tell you that they feel a certain way. If someone doesn't like another person, there's usually a fight. If someone doesn't like something another character did, it always winds up coming down to like almost the end of the world in some cases, or the end of the universe or something. That this is not a very literal movie, and neither is Hunt for Red October, that a lot of it is things that could happen, the internal struggles that these characters have. So I can see that. And I wish I could see more of that in other films, as opposed to Guardians of the Galaxy.
That's just good character and world building. That's what it's all about.
Yeah, we should probably not make everyone hate us more. Because it's a good movie.
I haven't seen it. Don't ruin it.
Yeah, I'm not going to ruin it. I will just tell you that everyone likes it except Dan and I think it's fine. So,
well, you can go listen to that episode after you've seen it, and then we can ruin it for you that way.
Okay, that's fine.
No, please don't do it. If you come out of the movie theater and you're just like, oh, this is the best thing I've ever seen, don't listen to us talk about it, because it won't make you feel very good about yourself.
I'm pretty sure that's what Mike has decided to do.
Okay. Yeah.
Well, for what it's worth, I've seen the trailers and I thought they were just awful. But everyone I know swears that the movie's great, except you two. So I'm inclined to believe I would enjoy it, but I don't know. I'm skeptical.
I think you'd like it. And like I said, we just said it was fine. We don't hate it. So it's fine.
Great.
All right. So shall we button this up?
We got to get you a new outro tag. You keep saying button this up, and I keep wanting to cut that out.
Well, you should cut it,
people's ending tags.
You should cut it out, and you should just like bleep over it, and then everybody will just wonder what I said. It'll just be let's, and then no one will know.
Once upon a time, I was of the mind to lay your burden. I could, you'd seen it done before. I could read your thoughts.